include For Her Own Good, 150 Years of Advice to Women, and The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment. Her most recent book is entitled Fear of Falling, and it is about the middle class. It looks closely at one segment of that class, that is the segment that includes teachers, scientists, doctors, lawyers, government bureaucrats, and journalists, all of those people whose status rests mostly on their education. It is a class that, she says, once took pride in its concern for those less well off. Then, however, things changed. Poverty was still there. Certainly that didn't go away. It seemed, however, that this part of the middle class lost interest. In the 60s, she writes, liberalism, as defined by the intention to achieve a more egalitarian society, was an affiliation worn with pride. But today, that term has denigrated into a slur. What happened in the life of this class, she asks, to cause this retreat from liberalism? That is the question that the book, Fear of Falling, attempts to answer. It is published by Pantheon, and we will talk about it this morning in this part of Focus 580. As we talk, we get you thinking. You may have some questions or some reaction to some of the things that our guest has to say, and we welcome your participation in the conversation. Locally here, the number to call is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line so that no matter where you are, you can be a part of the show and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And please, at any point here, if you want to jump in, do that. Ms. Ehrenreich, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, I'm glad to join you.
As your title would suggest, this book is in large part about middle class fears. What is the fear of falling? What is it that these people that you're writing about are afraid of?
Well, there are two parts to it. One is a sort of obvious fear of just losing status economically, which is a very, very real fear these days. These are days of a tremendous amount of confusion in terms of our whole social stratification system. Some people are slipping down, some are rising up, and there is a justifiable fear of losing ground. It could be through losing a job, losing a spouse, all sorts of things. I think we many of us who might otherwise be quite affluent suffer from what some psychologists call bag lady syndrome, where we can imagine losing our jobs, our homes, whatever. So it's partly about that kind of economic anxiety. But the other theme is something, I don't know what to call it, more psychological, slightly more irrational, which is a fear of losing it, of losing willpower, self-discipline, a fear of being spoiled by the affluence, the very affluence that the middle class seeks, and then losing that kind of edge that it takes to succeed.
Hmm. Well, the book is also about over time, the ways in which the middle class, in particular the segment of the middle class, has realized that they were not alone, that there were other classes, and that in some of them had very strong feelings about some of these other people in these other classes had very strong feelings about the middle class, or at least the middle class thought so. And you begin your story in the post-war years, in the 50s, which you explain was a time when the middle class came to believe that they and their way of life were America. They looked around them and looked out of their picture windows and over their lawns and across the street to the lawn of the house across the street and somehow felt that all America was like this, that life would only continue to improve and that the main way we would measure quality of life would mostly have to do with material terms. It was a time when, in the minds of many people, we, at least some of these middle class people, we had finally achieved a classless society because everybody was middle class. Certainly, there were some people who were worried about that. They were worried about this ethic of consumption. There were some people who. Boy, we've got a terrible telephone connection.
Yes.
I tell you what. Yeah. How about if we I get my director to redial the number and see if that might Well, now it's okay now.
Just saying that.
Okay, I'm going to ask Mike if he will redial the number, and maybe we'll get a better line. How about that?
Okay.
Okay. I apologize here to people who are listening. We're going to redial our guest and see if we can get a little bit better phone line. That's the problem with technology. Sometimes it doesn't always work very well for you. And we're kind of at the mercy of the long-distance phone lines we get, and it's generally a matter of luck or accident. Sometimes we get good ones, and others are not very good. From time to time over the years, I've talked to people here within this state and other places, and sometimes you would think you were calling somebody who was on the moon. It was that bad, and other times it's very good. So it's just a matter of chance. We're going to redial the guest again, and as we don't want to have to make you sit there and listen to our conversation through all this static and crackling. Let me just tell you real quick that on our afternoon magazine today, the topic will be how the U of I responded to the Chinese crisis. Of course, we're talking about the brutal put-down of the democracy movement in China back in the spring. At that time, there were a lot of U of I people in China, both faculty and students. And we'll be talking with Nancy Marks, who is the associate director of the U of I International Office of Student Affairs. And that will be our guest in the conversation part of the afternoon magazine. Now, of course, the afternoon magazine starts at noon, and there is news and weather and all kinds of things, but they also have a period where they take telephone calls from people who are listening, as we do here this morning on Focus, and that is the 1 o'clock hour of the show. That will be the topic today, and not only will there be that interview, but you can participate in it. Okay, we will try again here with Barbara Ehrenreich. Sounds better.
Yes, I can hear you anyway, David.
Okay, good. Okay, anyway, I was talking about this this post-war era in which the middle-class folks came to believe that they and their way of life really were America. And while some people might have been worried about all this consumption, thinking that maybe it wasn't very healthy, certainly some people rebelled against the conformity of middle-class life. In large part, the middle class felt fairly satisfied until they discovered poverty. Why was that such an important discovery, and how did that happen?
Well, I would just underline, David, you know, how strange it is that poverty had to be discovered. By Michael Harrington's estimate in his book, The Other America, which played quite a role in waking the middle class up to the existence of poverty, he estimated that about 20% or one out of five Americans lived in poverty at that time, early 60s. And yet this one-fifth of America just hadn't been noticed because this myth was so tenacious that we were a classless society. Very important myth of the 50s. So with the discovery of poverty, which certainly President Kennedy had something to do with, the civil rights movement had a great deal to do with, then that was the first sort of click, you might say, of awakening for the professional, the white-collar middle class, to the idea that America was not a land of just universal affluence. Mm-hmm. And first, that was a very, I think, very important liberal sort of discovery because the mood was, well, we can do something about poverty. In fact, most experts believed it would be it's sort of a mop-up job, you know, that it was a small thing, and then we'd just be on our way to having to deal with what they saw as a real problem, which was too much affluence.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, as you point out, that when people started to think about poverty in America, one of the things that they told themselves was, well, it's not so bad because our poor aren't as bad as everybody else is poor. You know, somehow the trickle-down of affluence had at least done that America's poor weren't as bad off as the poor of the second or third world.
Yes, and see, this discovery was really a big media event. News magazines had cover stories, TV specials, everything. And, you know, in amongst all the sort of shock of finding these poor people were this theme of, well, look, they do have television sets, they do have refrigerators. We really have very affluent poor people. It's interesting. Today, I don't think that could be said. Oh, America's poor. You know, the bottom level of poverty here is homelessness, which puts you sort of, in a global sense, on a refugee status. You don't get any poorer than that.
Well, is it the case then that, you know, when we talk about middle class fears, that this was a time when people shifted from worrying that they had too much to worrying that they might lose what they had?
No, the fear was still of affluence. I mean, as our leading intellectuals defined it, that was America's biggest problem. It was spoiling the young. It was destroying willpower. It had produced a conformist society that was probably even too soft to keep up with the Russians. That was the fear. Now, what interested me then was that in the discovery of the poor, if we can put quote marks around the word discovery, mm-hmm. That very quickly a kind of a stereotype was attached to the poor, which resembled very much, I mean, which you could say was a projection of what the middle class feared for itself. Because in the middle class stereotype, the poor were described as lazy. I guess affluent people have always seen the poor as lazy. But as self-indulgent and incapable of deferring gratification, promiscuous, really a people, you know, sort of, they'd almost describe the poor as the ultimate consumers, sort of people who could not control their impulses at all. So that, I think that was, you know, already a step away from a more liberal problem-solving approach to poverty to what became the dominant attitude by the 80s is that poor are poor because that's a mental problem they have. They have a character defect.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is very much a projection of middle-class anxieties about what was happening to the middle class.
In the 60s, the middle class found itself under attack by its own children. And you seem to be suggesting that response to that attack was, again, another step in this process of the middle class inching itself over towards the right. And that the elders of this generation blamed themselves for the student movement of the 60s. They took this point of view that said, you know, we gave them everything, we made it too easy for them, and now look what they've done. They're turning around and they're attacking everything that we believe in and we stand for, and that they're really not interested in building anything up, they're only interested in tearing things down. You suggest that
I think it was a key turning point.
Yeah.
And to tell you the truth, I didn't expect that when I started working on this book. I just hadn't weighed the student movement of the radicalism of the 60s as being that important to the kind of political direction our leadership had taken by the 80s. But it was really right there. So many important intellectuals, professors, journalists, commentators, who had been leading lights of liberalism in the 60s, responded with real horror to the student left, to the counterculture, the hippies, because they saw their own positions in society being threatened. Because the student movement really criticized the university. It criticized the authority of so-called experts and professionals. And really, you know, sometimes you could say this was anti-intellectual. Sometimes I think it was a very profound and important question to say, what is the basis of authority or expertise in our society? And why does, why do we have this kind of hierarchy that says that some people should earn so much more because their kind of knowledge is so much more important than others? That was very distressing, I think, to a very important liberal stratum of the liberal intelligentsia. And by, you know, I devote a chapter of my book to their responses to the student movement, which were pretty virulent. By the end of the 60s and early 70s, these liberal intellectuals had become neoconservative intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
They no longer felt the same kind of overall commitment toward solving problems like poverty or becoming a more egalitarian society at all.
You suggest as I said, that these people really, they blamed themselves for this rebellion of the youth, and that that it was, first of all, that it was a mistake, that it didn't really have anything to do with their style of parenting, and that it also helped to lay the groundwork for this resurgence of conservatism. What, in your view, what was the real cause for the rise of the student movement, and how did the way that these formerly liberal intellectuals react, how did that have this effect of laying the groundwork for this rise of conservatism?
Well, I think the reasons for the student movement, the youth movement of the 60s, were, you know, pretty much what we said they were at the time. I say we because I was one of those student activists in the 60s. You know, the racism, the war in Vietnam, other social problems we were addressing. But I also think you can say that there's a deeper tension in the professional middle class between youth and adults, which is bound to keep cropping up. Because this is a class which, well, to put it somewhat dramatically, really exploits its young, cannibalizes its young. You cannot really become an adult in the fullest sense in the professional middle class until you've finished high school, finished college, and beyond that, done what may be 2 to 8 years of further educational work. And then you may have another period of apprenticeship as a resident if you want to be a doctor, as a lower-level lawyer if you want to become a partner sometime in the firm. I'm not passing a judgment too much on that. That's our system, except to say that invariably creates a tension. And in the 60s, we had, in a sense, a whole generation of young people that said we're not really interested in being apprentices and being sort of sub-adults for so long. We really feel we have something to say and contribute now. So I think that there is that dynamic locked into the middle class. Now, the intellectuals' response, the adult intellectuals' response was, your problem, you kids, your problem is you're just spoiled,
mm-hmm.
Which was, of course, another way, you know, it was returning to that problem they had seen in affluence, that affluence would spoil people. And this seemed to be the living proof now, you know, that a whole generation had, in their minds, gone bad. I would just point out here one reason I emphasize this backlash by the intellectuals, professors and so on, is I think in the way that we have conventionally rewritten history, the backlash is the blue-collar backlash against the civil rights movement, against the student movement. I think we need to be reminded that probably the most influential backlash and right turn came from relatively privileged, relatively well-educated, members of the professional middle class, not the working class.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting that you point out that like their elders, the student activist of the 60s really bought into this myth, this stereotype of the working class that they had been handed, and certainly the media, you know, played its role there. This characterization of the working class as basically being a lot of guys like Archie Bunker, they bought into that and missed an opportunity for that there was a natural convergence there in the goals of the students and a lot of people in the working class, and that they missed the opportunity to come together there because they had bought into this stereotype of what the working class was all about that was in fact rather far from the truth.
Oh, yes. I think there's no question about that. Just to backtrack a minute, you know, the working class had to be discovered, too.
Mm-hmm.
And just as we had the discovery of poverty in 1963-64, there really was a very parallel media discovery of the white, blue-collar working class in 1969. Again, the news magazines had cover stories saying, you know, here are these neglected, forgotten Americans. You know, Nixon had talked about the silent majority and middle Americans. And this became a big theme in 1969. But again, we had a very stereotyped discovery. The discovery of the working class was not a discovery from a middle-class point of view of all the diversity of the American working class, but it focused in on a stereotype, which was, as you said, Archie Bunker. It was the hard hat. It was a bigoted, reactionary, very conservative, parochial sort of person. And I think that the student movement bought into that stereotype and did not see, on the whole, the American working class as real allies for the changes it wanted. And that's ironic, because if any class was, you know, most opposed to the war in Vietnam, it was the working class more than the professional middle class.
Mm-hmm. And again, here it seems to be that the fear of falling operates because the middle class perceived real hostility directed at them by the working class and what they were trying to do. And perhaps one of the things that fostered this, again, this creeping towards the right, was they were trying to blunt what they saw as an attack, which may in fact not have been there. Am I reading right?
Yeah, pretty much. I think, you know, the spirit in which poverty was discovered was one of paternalism. All right, we have these people. We'll help them somehow. So, of course, they weren't helped much. The spirit in which the working class was, quote, discovered in 1969 was much more negative kind of feeling, because the working class, no matter how exactly you define it, is an American majority. You know, if you include blue-collar, pink-collar people and various white-collar people who really are not professionals or managers but should be called working class, you've got the majority there. And according to the stereotype in the late 60s, this was a very conservative majority. And that made those who were still liberals in the, you know, and commentators and opinion makers in the middle class say, oh, wait, who are we then? We thought we were everybody. We thought we were the middle class. And if here's a majority that doesn't agree with us and it is so much more conservative than us, then we have some catching up to do. I think that there was a sort of a spirit of almost self-hatred that arose in among the middle-class intelligentsia at that point.
Mm-hmm.
That real Americans, the sort of salt-of-the-earth types now, were supposed to be reactionaries, were supposed to be racist. So those, say, who were media executives or newscasters or journalists started suddenly reassessing who they were. Now, the stereotype of the working class is wrong. Here's another irony and a painful one, that if anything, the working class is more liberal, not less, than the professional middle class. And this is shown in how people vote for president, for example. You know, look at the exit polls and the breakdown by education or income. It's shown in party alignment, that the less you earn and, you know, if you don't wear a white collar, the more of you are likely to be a Democrat than a Republican. I mentioned other issues like the war in Vietnam. Polls showed more resistance and anger about the war from the working class. But that was the stereotype. And the movies throughout the 70s kept repeating that stereotype. Dumb, bigoted, somewhat violent, macho men, as in movies like Saturday Night Fever or The Deer Hunter,
mm-hmm.
all showed that. Mm-hmm. So I think these stereotypes, I know, have persisted, and it means that the professional middle class lives in a very illusory world and in an illusion about what the rest of society is about. An illusion, I would say, of our own making, too.
We're talking this morning with Barbara Ehrenreich about some of the ideas in her recent book, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. Again, this morning, our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich. She's the author of a number of books. And her work, her writing regularly appears in the Washington Post, the New York Times Magazine, also magazines such as The Atlantic, The Nation, and The New Republic. She is currently a regular columnist for Ms. Magazine and Mother Jones. And her most recent book is Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. Maybe you have comments or questions on anything we've talked about so far. You can certainly be a part of the show. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. I wonder what you think about this notion. It seems to me, as I read your book, that I keep coming back to this feeling that the middle class has, in a way, always been at war with itself, and there has always been a great deal of unease about what the middle class stood for and whether that was good or not. It seems that even today, when we are, or in the period where you talk about the rise of the neoconservatives and the new right, that even that is still a form of this war within the middle class. It seems to me that while people on the right might not agree, that in many ways the new right is not all that much different from their enemies on the left. I mean, certainly there are ideological differences, but it seems to me in some rare fundamental ways, this is still a family squabble.
Oh, that's one of my points here, that where I'm looking in the book at the shift toward a more conservative outlook on the part of the professional middle class, but it's all within the one class that we're watching this shift, where there hasn't, for example, been an overall rightward shift on the issues as measured by opinion polls and surveys. But there certainly has been such a shift on the part of our opinion makers, who, almost by definition turn out to be members of the professional middle class. And you see some of the same prejudices toward other classes in both sides, in the liberal and conservative side. The liberal view of the poor that we were talking about, a very paternalistic view of the poor, becomes the more up-to-date 1980s stereotype of the underclass, which is very much a conservative stereotype, where now the promiscuousness and the laziness of the poor have become almost incurable in the rights outlook. But yes, there's certainly a lot of commonality. In fact, if you want to be really sweeping about it, you could say the professional middle class is a minority class. It's only about 20% of the population at most. If it wants to get anywhere, it wants to get its class interests advanced, it has to either ally with those who are less affluent, poor people, working people, or with the people who are more affluent, the very wealthy. And if you do the latter, that's the conservative approach. That's the approach where you see the big money people as the corporate elite, et cetera, as the best forces in society, and that would be the neoconservative tack. The liberal strategy, you could say, just to be quite sweeping and provocative about this, is to say, no, we won't get anywhere unless we ally with the majority that is less affluent. Mm-hmm. So you could say that's left or right, amount to decide for the middle class, amount to deciding who to line up with, the wealthy minority or the working class majority.
Well, I have a couple of callers here I'd like to bring into our conversation. Let's do that, and we'll start with our line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello. Ms. Ehrenreich, I've read your book, and I found it really fascinating. And I had a couple of questions. In one part of the book, you speak about how the middle class is becoming so insular that they're only marrying within their class. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that. And also, and later on in the book, when you talk about who's really in charge and how a middle-class couple who's earning over $100,000 a year is really kidding themselves if they think they have much power.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to find someone who read the book there in Illinois. The point on marriage is interesting because the book is by no means all about economics. It's also about child-raising, marriage, even diet fads, all these aspects of the inner life. But in the, say, 50s, it was not unusual for an executive to marry his secretary, a doctor to marry his nurse. Today, things have changed. The doctor will marry another doctor. An executive would be looked down upon if he married a secretary. So there's been a kind of tightening of the ranks, and only made possible because of the inroads that middle-class women have made into the professions that used to be just for middle-class men. So, yeah, I think and I cite sociologists who are observing this closing of ranks in the middle class. The $100,000 a year couple is saying, do they really have much power? I think the people I were quoting, this is as we come to the end of the book, toward the end of the 80s, are complaining that $100,000 a year isn't enough money for a family, that we seem to have gotten on a new treadmill where no amount is enough if you count in the extremely high cost of housing in many of our cities and count in college tuitions, which can be over $20,000 a year now in the Ivy League and average about $7,000 a year in the state universities. So there's a new feeling of being just unable to, you know, stop what became the kind of yuppie pattern of earn and spend as fast as you can.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I appreciate the call. Let us go on to another caller here, line number two. Hello.
You indicated you thought that workers were more liberal than most people think they are. Workers are liberal on economic issues that affect them, the Social Security, unemployment comp, workman's comp, minimum wage, and so on and so on. They tend to be much more conservative on some of the social issues, which makes them vulnerable to the Mr. Ailes and Mr. Atwater and other advisors of Republican presidential candidates who are then able to move away from the economic issues and never discuss them and instead discuss capital punishment, prayer in the schools, gun control, flag issues, and so on. And to get workers faked out to some degree to where they vote on those issues, not understanding that they are the only group in our society that doesn't vote its own economic self-interest. For instance, if I'm a doctor, I vote on one issue, my own economic self-interest, which has to do with Medicare and what the government will do about capping my fees and so on. If I'm a big businessman, I vote Republican because it's in my own economic self-interest. If I'm a wealthy lawyer, I tend to vote Republican because of tax breaks and so on. And so the working people are the only group in our society, half of them, I should say, who vote against their own economic self-interest and get faked out by the Roger Ailes and the Lee Atwaters of the world into voting on such things as capital punishment and prayer in the schools and flag issues and so on and so on.
Well, I think you're right about the right strategy, which has been to use those social issues to get working people to vote against their economic self-interest. That's absolutely true, but I do think we exaggerate sometimes the conservatism of the working class also on social issues. I'll give you one example just because I happen to have looked into this one pretty carefully, is a degree of support for feminism, for women's liberation. The stereotype, right, is that the typical feminist is a young, yuppie woman with attaché case and sneakers and so on. Actually, support for feminism rises slightly as you go down the socioeconomic scale.
Well, certain aspects of feminism, they see their sisters and their wives being abused at work in the sense of being underpaid and overworked and this sort of thing. And so they're very strongly in favor of equal wages for women in the plants and so on. But that doesn't carry over as far as you would think in the feminism. It only certain aspects of feminism.
Well, I don't see how you can say that with such certainty.
I work with unions and with workers every day. I teach classes for them, and I came out of the working class myself. And we discuss these kinds of things every day when we're in classes. That's why I'm speaking that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had experiences mostly with working women as well as working class men, which suggests a broader tolerance that I think is often attributed to them. I think there's a tremendous bias on the part of the white collar and educated folks to look down and say, well, even if they are liberal, it's just narrow self-interest, unlike some of us.
One last comment. I would agree that there is much more liberalism out there and much more goodwill and much more decency among workers than most people would ever guess. And much more sensitivity to 101 issues. Many people think because a person's a worker, all dirty from head to foot, that he would not be a sensitive human being, and he's just as sensitive as anyone else, if not more so, because of the hurts they've received.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just trying to turn over the ugly stereotypes that the affluent have had for the last 20 years of the less affluent.
I'd just like to jump in here for a second, and we'll talk with some other callers. I'd just like to remind people listening we have about 10 minutes left, and to reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Barbara Ehrenreich about some of the ideas in her book, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. Pantheon is the publisher. Let's go on to another caller here, line number 3. Hello?
Yes, I was interested when Miss Ehrenreich was talking to find myself thinking about President Reagan and what his experience had been of the classes and how it might have varied in his lifetime and how maneuverable he was with other classes and how those classes probably maneuvered him. And then my thoughts went to Lyndon Johnson and to Franklin Roosevelt, and I wondered if anybody has done a study of famous men or leaders along this line that she knows about.
I think in our society we tend not to look at the class dimension often enough, and it helps explain a lot, helps clarify a lot of things. Reagan started in a poor working class family, and as we all know, became a spokesman for the very rich. I mean, certainly his economic policies favored the very rich, tax cuts for the very rich and social spending cuts for the poor. How that came about is, I hope we'll find out in his autobiography. But that's the picture there.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to line number 1 for another caller. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Barbara, would you like to comment on how the United States' recent status as a debtor nation and the seemingly inevitable austerity in the future is going to impact the attitudes of the middle class? I don't know if you deal with that in your book, but perhaps that's what it's about to some extent. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thank you for the call.
It's a good question. I suspect we could continue to see more of what I call the yuppie strategy in the book, that is middle-class young people, students, deciding very early that they're not going to take a chance with a profession like even medicine, definitely not history or literature or something like that, that they're going to go try to make it into the what's really an international corporate managerial class, to go into things like management, to go into banking very early in life. That's the kind of strategy that I think that certainly young people have been following in the 80s, putting aside their idealism very young and saying, well, how am I going to make it in this in what could be an ever more threatening world? It's a scary strategy. I don't know what we do when we have an educated class that's entirely composed of bankers, accountants, and managers, and we don't have people who, actually produce things or teach people or so on, but that's what people have been doing.
Some people might say that, and it it might be too hasty a conclusion, but might say that the yuppie strategy tarnished pretty quickly, and that we decided that we really disliked the conspicuous consumption and the self-absorption that seemed to be the hallmarks of these people, although one could argue that might also be a stereotype, and that what we're doing is we're once again embarked on this search for real values that we can live with, and that leads some to predict that maybe as the 80s were rather like the 50s, that perhaps the 90s will be like the 60s. And I wonder what you think about all that.
Well, I don't know that there's any real reason to think there's going to be this 30-year cycle. Arthur Schlesinger talks about this. That's a 30-year cycle. 90s will be like the 60s. I don't know. I don't see a lot of change in that trend I just mentioned, that young middle-class people are continuing their exodus out of the liberal arts and the natural sciences and into those things that look like they'll be lucrative real fast. That goes on. In 1987, Newsweek announced it was the end of the 80s, the end of yuppies, the end of greed. I don't see really that it's happened yet. I keep waiting. Now, there are little straws in the wind. I think that the response, for example, to Malcolm Forbes' $2 million birthday bash was interesting. There was a real revulsion. I think we're coming out of the period of the 80s where we just romanticized the rich and famous. We're beginning, you know, we're raising questions about, is that how we really judge people? Are there different values? Haven't we gone too far with the materialism? I think the very vulgar behavior of some of our rich, like the Trumps and like, you know, the Helmsleys and Forbes, is contributing to this. Whether we actually find some new values or not, I don't know.
Okay. Let's talk with someone else here. We'll go to the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, Barbara. I have noticed since Reagan was president that he has pitted one class against the other. In other words, the middle class looks down on the lower class, the upper class looks down on the middle class, and the consumer has no lobbyists in Washington. The laws are made by the rich for the rich against the poor.
Well, I think there's a certain unhappy truth to what you're saying because, well, it's not only that, it's the dependence today. I'm sure you're thinking of also of politicians on the wealthy because as our campaigns get more TV dependent, our politicians get more dependent on the big money guys.
They're owned by the rich people.
Right, and then you don't have a democracy, you have a plutocracy. And I think, you know, that's where we ended up, and now we have Bush campaigning to cut taxes for the very wealthy again with a capital gains tax cut. I don't see an end in sight unless a lot of people who are middle class, working class, whatever, able to get together and, you know, say, no, we have to start going in a more egalitarian, democratic direction again.
But they don't contribute to the elections. Just think, if the middle class would just contribute $1 a week, there is no rich corporation that could muster as much money as the middle class could in this country for election purposes. I'm talking about local, state, and federal.
Not a bad idea. I think it's a good idea.
You know, they spend that much on a hot dog or on a Pepsi Cola every day.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe we don't.
They're unorganized.
Maybe we don't need all those television campaign ads just telling us how bad the other guy is anyway.
Right.
Maybe there'd be a better way of getting the information out so we can make our judgments.
And we have to vote. I think only 38% of the people voted in the last election, the eligible voters, only 38%. Is that true?
I'm not sure. I think it was even, I know it was lower in 84 than 38, so it might have been a little lower this time too.
And the people in Europe are ready to die to be able to vote, right?
Yes, and they see us as a model of democracy, but I think we could improve and be a much better model for the world.
I gotta jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I hate to do that to folks. It's just that we're pretty much down to the wire here, and we're out of time, and we're going to have to stop. I would just like to if the caller wouldn't mind, ask just one last question. You write in your book that what we need is in this country is a revival of conscience and responsibility in the middle class, and then raise the questions, and I'm not sure whether they're rhetorical or they're questions you have answers for, you know, raise the questions, how will that come? Will it come, and from where will it come? What do you think?
Well, I think one place it's going to come from is, it's going to come from the hearts, I think, of some of the young people who are making decisions like, am I going to follow my ideals and be whatever it is, an astronomer or a social worker or whatever, or am I going to try to, you know, go for the quick money in a business-related field? That's one place it's going to come from, is young people who are going to say, it's self-denial. I don't want to go into banking. I really want to do the other. I think that people have been giving up a lot to be on this treadmill we've gotten ourselves into by the 80s, that we've been repressing other values, other needs, and those other values and other needs are going to bubble up. I don't think we can continue like this. As one caller mentioned, I talk in the book about people, couples complaining they make $100,000, $200,000 a year and still can't make it, still don't have enough. Now that there's something very, very wrong then. You know, because that they're the economically most fortunate of us. Mm-hmm. So I think we may be on the verge of a reevaluation, just because people can't live like this forever.
Well, we must leave it at that. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome, Dave.
Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, and if you're interested in reading more of her thoughts on this topic, look for her book, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, and it is published by Pantheon Books.